Hello. Welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa with the News Gazette on this Wednesday, July 2nd, 2025. Hope you're staying cool today. On the front page, there's a cute picture of a little guy named Jet Tackett, a four-year-old from Louisville, Illinois, who's using a raccoon structure to spray others at the water park at Kelly Moore Memorial Park in Arcola, where temperatures reached into the mid-80s on Tuesday. Temperatures around east central Illinois are expected to remain in the high 80s and low 90s throughout the weekend, including Independence Day. The forecast for Friday calls for sunny skies and a high around 93 degrees during the daytime. And it's a large color picture on that front page with this little boy, and the heading is "In the Heat of Combat." It's pretty cute. At the top of the front page is an article about OSF healthcare by Jana Wiersema, and the heading is "Filing OSF cites $361 million in losses, drop to 8.5% of the market share in Urbana. Open heart surgery, comprehensive physical rehabilitation, and intensive care are among the services OSF Healthcare seeks to eliminate in its Urbana location, part of its plan to scale back to one hospital with two campuses. The company is proposing to discontinue these offerings along with pediatrics and cardiac catheterization at its Urbana-based Heart of Mary Medical Center, according to a permit application on file with the Illinois Health Facilities and Service Review Board. The 71-page document filed this week revealed more details than were announced earlier last month when OSF went public with plans to operate its Danville and Urbana locations as one licensed hospital, OSF Sacred Heart Medical Center, with two campuses. The preferred timing is to implement the discontinuations in January of 2026, the company wrote in its filing. As part of the reconfiguration of services at the hospital, the 110 authorized medical surgical beds will be reduced to a count of 25 beds. Additionally, the surgery department with 15 operating rooms is slated to close. OSF plans to operate 40 acute mental illness beds in Urbana and continue the location's emergency department, diagnostic imaging, outpatient services, lab, and pharmacy. The plan is to transfer most of Urbana's general surgery, orthopedics, gastroenterology, and pulmonary cases to OSF Sacred Heart Medical Center in Danville. The company wrote, adding that the cardiology program and staff would be shifted to Bloomington. Home to OSF's St. Joseph Medical Center. OSF cited financial losses, low utilization volumes, and difficulty with recruitment and retention of specialty physicians as factors in its proposal to discontinue services. The company reported that the Urbana location's losses have totaled over $361 million since OSF bought the hospital from Presence in September of 2017. The figure includes the cost of purchase, capital investments, and annual operating losses. Furthermore, OSF claimed that the Urbana Hospital's market share has decreased from 20% in 2018 to 8.5%, while Carle Foundation Hospital's share grew from 65.6% to 76%. The five programs being discontinued have significant operating expenses that are not covered by the decline in revenues associated with these programs, OSF wrote in its filings. OSF's continued subsidization of these services is not sustainable, since there are many other competing demands for financial resources by its ministry programs in other communities. The company wrote that it also considered closing the Urbana Hospital completely and transferring all services to Danville. However, OSF decided against this option, writing that the area needs acute mental illness services as well as continued emergency care and supporting services. The company said that its ability to offer the to-be-discontinued continued services during the remainder of the 2025 year may be impacted by its ability to maintain physician coverage and staffing, and exact timing will depend on its ability to manage operations during months of anticipated declining patient volumes and staff coverage. Some of the vacated pediatrics and medical surgical bed areas will be converted to inpatient psychiatry, OSF officials wrote. For other space being vacated, it is not anticipated that it will be converted to other clinical use. As of this time, the specific plan for utilization of space has not been determined. Members of the public can request that the state hold a public hearing on the proposal. Requests must be submitted in writing by mail to Mike Constantino, Supervisor, Project Review Section, Illinois Health Facilities and Services Review Board, 525 West Jefferson Street, 2nd floor, Springfield, Illinois, 62761. Public comments on the proposal can be submitted to the same address. Another article on the front page from the Village of Savoy, from its board, by Jana Wiersema, with the heading Partial Removal of Median at Walmart Entry on Agenda. If left unchanged, it's expected to create traffic conflicts for drivers trying to exit. As construction continues on a fast food restaurant set to open in September, village officials are considering changes to a nearby median that often poses an obstacle to motorists. At its study session tonight, the village board will discuss a proposal to pay up to $80,000 to remove part of the raised median at the south entrance to Walmart, which would also affect the McDonald's under construction at 509 South Dunlap Avenue. According to Public Works staff, the restaurant is slated to open September 1st. According to Public Works Director Roland White, the median was put in due to Illinois Department of Transportation requirements that were in place when the subdivision was originally built. This raised median was constructed too far back into the site and blocks the existing frontage road, he wrote in a report to the village board. Drivers traveling southbound on the frontage road trying to exit the commercial development are forced to make a U-turn maneuver around the existing median. This maneuver causes traffic conflicts at the existing entrance. The area is subject to traffic not just from Walmart, but also from other businesses located east of the supermarket, including a gas station, a smoke shop, a pet clinic, a boutique, and an antiques shop. White noted that the new McDonald's will have to deal with the same issues as these existing shops and likely cause a significant increase in traffic on the frontage road. As a result, the traffic conflict with the U-turn maneuvers will become much worse, he concluded. In order to address this problem, village staff have created a design to remove a portion of the median. IDOT has issued a permit allowing the proposed changes, White said. The engineer's cost estimate, which includes a 10% contingency, is a little under $62,000, and bids are scheduled to be opened on July 8th. Funding for the work is available at the village's capital improvement budget under local motor fuel tax projects line item. Action will not be taken at today's meeting. The village board will simply decide whether to place its item on next week's agenda for a vote. And the final article on the front page, under Champaign County Court, from Urbana, Champaign man to serve 18 years for sex assault. A Champaign man has been sentenced to a total of 18 years in prison after he was found guilty of sexually assaulting a woman in the backyard of a house where neither of them lived. Eugene Joyner, 26, was found guilty of two counts of aggravated sexual assault for the March 17, 2024 incident. A woman he had sexually encounter with around a month earlier called 911 to report that while the pair was walking outside in the early hours of that day, Joyner had pulled her behind a house and sexually assaulted her. He also struck her with an unknown object, leaving her bleeding on her face. The previous encounter was consensual, she said, but she blocked Joyner and didn't want further contact after she found him to be rude the following day. He allegedly continued to attempt to make contact with her, seemingly concerned about her possibility of being pregnant. On March 17th, she said she got home from work late and was talking to a friend in her room when Joyner appeared outside the window and asked that she come with him to get a pregnancy test. The woman said she had just been discussing going to the gas station to get a drink, so she agreed, but first asked Joyner to come to the front door so he would be caught on her landlord's security cameras. She said the pair walked to two different gas stations, which both turned out to be closed, before Joyner asked her to get him a hotel room. She told him she didn't want to have sex with him, but would help him get somewhere to stay. When they weren't able to get a room, they began walking back to the woman's house. She said that he grabbed her wrist and wouldn't let her go, but that she didn't feel fearful as he approached multiple houses in search of an outdoor spigot to fill his water bottle so she could get a drink. It wasn't until Joyner said he knew someone at one house who could give her a drink, then pulled her into that backyard, and she became afraid, the woman said. The woman also alleged Joyner threatened her with what she thought was a firearm at the time, but she heard a rattling and wondered if it was a BB gun. A jury ultimately found him not guilty of using a firearm in the assault. Investigators believe that whatever the item was, a real firearm or not, Joyner used it to strike the victim's face and head. A nurse who examined the woman shortly after police arrived had her transferred to the hospital confirmed finding signs that she had been sexually assaulted. A forensic scientist said her analysis of samples taken from the woman showed that male DNA was found 9 quadrillion times more likely to have come from Joyner than any other individual. Joyner initially claimed he did not know the victim, but later testified that they had been together that night, but it was consensual and she must have gotten injured after he left. Assistant Public Defender Janie Miller represented Joyner in the trial, but he has since hired local attorney Jamie Props to represent him. Joyner filed a notion for a new trial, claiming ineffective counsel. Miller was brought to the stand on that issue in a hearing Monday, but Champaign County Judge Randy Rosenbaum ruled that she had taken appropriate steps as expected of a competent attorney. Props continued to represent Joyner through his sentencing. She requested the maximum 6 years on each count. Assistant State's Attorney Eileen Keeley requested 12 years on each count, significantly less than the maximum 30. Rosenbaum settled on 9 years for each count, acknowledging that Joyner is young and had several letters of support, but saying that the court still needs to send a message both to the defendant and to the community. In this case, it is mandatory. The sentence to be served consecutively. They will be followed by a period of mandatory supervised release, and Joyner will be required to register as a sex offender. Let's turn now to Section A6 under Capital News, Illinois, with an article with the heading, "And That's a Pair." This is under Election 2026. Pritzker selects former Deputy Governor Christian Mitchell, who oversaw infrastructure, clean energy projects for 4 years, as a running mate. Governor J.B. Pritzker announced Tuesday that former Deputy Governor Christian Mitchell will be his running mate for the 2026 campaign. Pritzker's selection, made just days after announcing a third campaign for governor, comes from a close circle of trust in Pritzker's administration. Mitchell previously served as one of four deputy governors overseeing key projects in Pritzker's first term. Christian Mitchell is a proven leader with deep experience, steady judgment, and an unshakable commitment to the working families of Illinois, Pritzker said in a statement. Whether it's transforming our clean energy future, rebuilding our infrastructure, or keeping our communities safe, Christian has been a force behind so much of our progress. I couldn't ask for a better partner to continuing delivering results for the people of Illinois. Mitchell, 38, will replace Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton on the ticket as she seeks the Democratic nomination for retiring U.S. Senator Dick Durbin's seat. Mitchell comes in with hefty experience in state government and public policy. A resident of Chicago's Hyde Park neighborhood, he served 3 terms in the Illinois House beginning in 2013 and was executive director of the Democratic Party of Illinois in 2018 before joining the governor's office in 2019. Mitchell left Pritzker's administration in early 2023 to become vice president for civic engagement at the University of Chicago, where he oversees government relations. He was appointed by Pritzker last year to an unpaid seat on the Metropolitan Pier and Exposition Authority Board, which oversees Navy Pier and McCormick Place. He is also a first lieutenant in the Illinois Air National Guard. The governor has led with courage and compassion, and together we've built a foundation that's moving Illinois forward, Mitchell said in a statement. I'm ready to build on that progress, lowering costs, expanding opportunity, and making sure every community has its resources and opportunities that they deserve. This is about delivering real results for the people of Illinois, and I'm excited to get to work. Though the lieutenant governor has few constitutional responsibilities in Illinois, Pritzker has leveraged the position to task Stratton with leading key legislative initiatives and overseeing the implementation of some of his administration's top priorities at state agencies. If Pritzker is elected to another term, the role will hold greater importance as he considers running for president in 2028. If Pritzker was elected president, Mitchell would be required to serve the final 2 years of his term. While keeping Mitchell's selection under wraps, Pritzker told reporters in recent days that he was looking for a running mate who was ready to immediately step into the governorship if required. The number one qualification is, can you do the job of being governor? Because if you're lieutenant governor, that may come to you, Pritzker said Monday. The second thing I think about is the person who I might choose for lieutenant governor, somebody who has a heart for the people of Illinois. Not just some or other specific segment of the population, because we have a big, diverse state. Deputy governors in Pritzker's administration have a role like a chief of staff overseeing specific policy areas and state agencies. Mitchell was in charge of environmental policy, infrastructure, and public safety. In 2020 and 2021, Mitchell oversaw the negotiations of Pritzker's marquee climate policy, the Climate and Equitable Job Acts. It massively reformed the utility and energy industry and requires all fossil fuel power plants to close by 2045. Mitchell was responsible for representing the governor in negotiations around the bill and was the face of the Pritzker administration as it went through the legislature. That law, passed in the wake of the bribery scandal with Chicago's electric utility that forced former House Speaker Michael Madigan to resign, cemented Pritzker's reputation as a progressive on climate issues. In the years since, energy experts and some lawmakers involved in passing the law have raised concerns that the state is at risk of missing the clean energy targets that Mitchell helped codify. Mitchell also oversaw the implementation of the 2019 Rebuild Illinois Capital Plan, a $45 billion construction project to rebuild roads, bridges, and other infrastructure across the state. Recreational cannabis regulation was also Mitchell's responsibility. Pritzker signed legislation in his first year legalizing cannabis for recreational use and setting up a series of regulations for dispensaries and new social equity requirements. As state lawmaker, Mitchell was chair of the House Economic Opportunity Committee. He also brings heavy political experience to the ticket. Democrats swept races for statewide offices in 2018 and won supermajorities in the state house, with Mitchell serving in a top leadership role under former party chair Mike Madigan. He took over for Tim Mapes, Madigan's former chief of staff, who was accused of sexual harassment and is now serving time in prison for a perjury conviction. He has also worked as an advisor on several political campaigns in Illinois, including leading Midwest polling for former President Barack Obama 2012 campaign. Let's turn now to J. Mark Powell's Holy Cow History. There's a very large and colorful picture of the famous John Trumbull's oil on canvas painting of the Declaration of Independence, commissioned in 1817, placed in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda in 1826, and featured on the back of the $2 bill. It depicts not the approval of the final version of the document on July 4th in 1776, which is marked as the United States Independence Day, nor the actual signing of the document, which took place on August 2nd, bought the committee of five, presenting the first draft of the document to the rest of the Second Continental Congress on June 28th at the Independence Hall in Philadelphia. It also does not depict a real scene, as Trumbull, the artist, was trying to capture as many signers as possible, and because the document was debated and signed over a period of time in which membership in Congress changed, the men depicted were never all in the same room at the same time. And his article that I will now read is titled, Happy July, whatever. For the 249th time, Americans are getting ready to haul out the hot dogs and fire up the fireworks for the nation's big birthday bash. It's a star-spangled party, the highlight of summer for millions. There will be parades and picnics and politicking. And, of course, fireworks. Lots and lots of fireworks. In fact, it's estimated Americans shell out about $1 billion every July 4th on things that go boom. Have you ever wondered why we observe America's birthday on this particular day? Sure, the Declaration of Independence was famously approved then, but we have just as easily could have picked July 2nd or July 15th or even August 2nd. They all have a claim on the honor. Although we had been engaged in an armed conflict with the British Redcoats for nearly 15 months by 1776, some delegates to the Second Continental Congress still hoped to patch things up with the mother country. But by early summer, they reached the conclusion that England had to go. Richard Henry Lee of Virginia proposed a resolution in June declaring America to be an independent nation. It was passed by unanimous vote on July 2nd. Many of our founding fathers thought it would be the day we commemorate our national independence. John Adams famously wrote his wife Abigail on July 3rd, "The second day of July, 1776, will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival." It ought to be commemorated as the Day of Deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations, from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forth and forevermore. While Adams was penning these words, his colleague Thomas Jefferson was busy scratching out a formal Declaration of Independence. The task was assigned to the Committee of Five, but Jefferson did the editorial heavy lifting. True, he borrowed heavily from Montesquieu's The Spirit of the Laws and from John Locke, but he had less than 48 hours to craft a document that he knew would unleash shockwaves on both sides of the Atlantic. So he did what college students under a tight deadline have done with their writing for generations. He cribbed a little bit. On July 4th, delegates approved the final version, which is why that date appears on the famous parchment copy now preserved in the National Archives. On July 15th, New York's delegates received permission from state authorities back home to support the document, which one might argue finalized the earlier vote. The July 19th entry in the Secret Journals of Congress, published in 1821, states, "Resolved that the declaration passed on the 4th be fairly engrossed on parchment, with the title and style of the Unanimous Declaration of the 13th United States of America, 13 United States, and that the same time when engrossed be signed by every member of Congress." Many modern researchers now conclude that the declaration was formally signed on August 2nd, which made it officially official. It seems nobody put their name on the declaration on July 4th. Signer Thomas McKeon wrote in 1796, "No person signed it on that day, nor for many days after." Does it matter which date actually marks America's actual birthday? Not really. The remarkable significance of what the Founding Fathers did far outweighs that specific day on which they did it. because each one literally laid it on the line by picking up the quill and putting their name to the declaration. They weren't joking when they agreed to mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Had things turned out differently, they might very well have wound up swinging at the end of a rope. So, happy July 2nd, or 4th, or 15th, or August 2nd. Oh well, long live the spirit of 76. Happy 4th to you, by the way. I'm going to segue from that to a notice here that might be important to all of you about the Champaign County Freedom Celebration. It says here in a red, white, and blue notice, parade changes, new parade time and route, starting at 4:30 p.m. U of I homecoming route. So it gives you a website to go for that. It does not give you the route here, but the website is www.july4th.net. And it says the Champaign County Freedom Celebration is excited to announce our 2025 event lineup. This year's theme is America Celebrates Pride of the Heartland with Grand Marshal, the Decker family from Philo, Illinois. The parade starts at 4:30 p.m. Evening entertainment is as follows. Nathan Applegate, Rising Star in Nashville. Fireworks beginning at dusk to 9:15 p.m. More activities include vendors, food trucks, kids' activities, inflatables, face painting, a flag ceremony with Champaign Fire Department, and a national anthem, patriotic soundtrack, or fireworks on WHMS 97.5. And so again, for more information, go to www.july4th.net, and there you will find the parade route for the 4th. And now back to Section A6 under our communities. An article by Bob Admison about the Dan's Game, fitting way to honor a friend from Danville. And there's a picture of some happy fellows raising a glass with the heading, The News Gazette Crew Toasts Late News Gazette Editor Tony Mancuso on Friday at a Danville Dan's Game in his honor. Tony would have loved it, would have loved the event selected to honor him because he was at this baseball game, the Dan's versus Champion City Kings at historic Danville Stadium. Who would have loved that so many family, friends, and co-workers were in the crowd? And he would have loved that his son Andrew threw out the first pitch, a perfect strike, with wife Dana and daughter Gabby right there cheering him on. He would have loved to see the impact he had and the lives he touched. We lost our friend Tony Mancuso way too soon in October. He had just turned 54. His bride of 28 years, Dana, suggested a connection with baseball, one of Tony's passions. It would be a fitting tribute. Tony's longtime News Gazette co-workers, Tom Kasick, Mike Gebel, and George Dobrik, made sure it happened. I really thought that was a great idea, Kasick said, because when you think about it, he loved baseball, and he loved youth sports, and he liked going to Danville Stadium. And Tony liked to talk about anything and everything. No subject was off limits or over his head. Kasick points out to baseball is the ideal sport for conversation. You can sit there and talk and not really miss anything, Kasick said. You can't do that with football or basketball or hockey. I'll bet you he enjoyed watching us do this. Of course they couldn't control the weather, which looked threatening in the area on Friday night. The first game of the doubleheader was delayed about 30 minutes, but before too long, the umpire yelled, "Play ball!" Tony was a lifelong St. Louis Cardinals fan who became a season ticket holder in recent years. He'd split the tickets with his friends, then make the three-hour drive to Busch Stadium whenever possible. Tony could tell you everything about the Cardinals' past, present, and future. The team was part of his family, going back to the days growing up in Metro East St. Louis. After he settled in Urbana, Tony became a regular on the local baseball scene. He helped coach Andrew during his youth playing days and beyond. At holiday parties, Tony would often bend your ear about the current team he was coaching or league he was serving on as commissioner. Anything for baseball. On the scene, the sponsors of Tony Mancuso Night were given 125 tickets to be distributed. All of them were gobbled up, and others paid their way in. The News Gazette was represented by about 20 current and former employees, including legend Lauren Tate. The 93-year-old drove himself to Danville, It was fun because there were all these different groups, Kasich said. There was the News Gazette group, and there was the neighborhood group. Andrew and all his pals from high school were there, and family members. They all came together and remembered Tony. It was a nice night. Perhaps getting a bit spiritual, Tony helped out with the weather. It rained everywhere but Danville, Kasich said. There was a little bubble over Danville Stadium. The beer, snow cones, and hot dogs were flying out of the concession stands. Kasich sponsored yearly Dan's games for about a decade. Andrew Mancuso threw out the first pitch when he was 10, full circle. Kasich was honored to be asked by Dana to help set up the event. It was a great idea. It was a home run, he said. Before the game, the public address announcement read the comments prepared by Kasich, which included memories of Tony. One night he went to a Danville Dans game and became smitten with this wonderful place and known as the Danville Stadium. So we grabbed a beer, soft drink, and bottled water to make a toast to Tony Mancuso, who would be so loved to cheer with us tonight. So, cheers. We're going to take a short break now. This has been the first half of the News Gazette. On July 2nd, I'll be back in just a short moment.